Welcome to Copper Country Today, Houghton Community Broadcasting's weekly look at the issues and people that are important to the Keweenaw. I'm Todd Van Dyke. This morning, we meet two men who are running for the nation's highest offices, Constitution Party presidential candidate Don Blankenship and vice presidential candidate William Moore will share their views. And our special series focuses on addiction and law enforcement. Copper Country Today is brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation. It's coming up.
When our community is in need, the Portage Health Foundation is here to answer the call. In 2018, we were here on the front lines helping homeowners get their lives back. And now with the COVID-19 pandemic, we're right here with the many nonprofits who help serve our community. We've provided funding to Senior Meals, Keweenaw Family Resource Center, and 31 Backpacks. We launched a Wi-Fi hotspot network to help families stay connected, and we have much more planned. If you want to donate to help our community's recovery, visit phfgive.org/COVID-19 or call 523-5920.
Good morning and welcome to segment one of Copper Country Today, brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation. We will continue our look at the problems of addiction in the Copper Country later on in the program. It is generally the goal of Copper Country Today to focus on local issues, but I have a unique opportunity this week to sit down and talk with a couple of politicians who work at the national level and are actually running for the highest offices in the land. Don Blankenship is here. He is the presidential nominee of the Constitution Party. And along with him is William Moore, who is the vice presidential nominee. And I welcome you both to the program this morning, and welcome to the Copper Country.
Thank you very much.
Good to be here, Ted.
Bill, you're from Michigan. You're from downstate.
Yes, that's correct. Martin, Michigan, just south of Grand Rapids a little bit.
I used to play my trombone with a trio out at Sam's Joint at Gun Lake for years.
Is that a fact? They are all out of business now, but that was a great place to eat.
Oh, the ribs were just delicious. The ribs were great. And Don Blankenship, presidential nominee, you're from West Virginia.
Yeah, born in Kentucky, grew up in West Virginia, lived all over the country.
We turned up the heat for you just to make you feel comfortable here in the Copper Country. You'll notice that we're a little more hot and a little more humid than we usually
are. It's a little humid for a guy that's living in Nevada right now.
Oh, you're living in Nevada now?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so it's not the heat, it's the humidity.
Yes.
The Constitution Party, at one point, help me to understand the history here, was known as the U.S. Taxpayer Party.
I'll let Bill explain that for you.
In Michigan, we are still the U.S. Taxpayers Party. We are the same people as the National Constitution Party, but the state of Michigan will not allow us to change our name and appear on the ballot as the Constitution Party. So you'll see us on the ballot as the U.S. Taxpayers Party in Michigan.
The rest of the nation has shifted over to the Constitution Party?
Primarily, we are known in some states like Nevada and California probably as the American Independent Party, but their affiliates, all of them are affiliates of the Constitution Party.
Do you have to have a lot of letterhead to keep all this straight?
Well, I don't try to keep it straight. I just figured that we got to get our message out there and people will find us on the ballot.
So, Don, talk to me about the basic tenets of the Constitution Party.
Well, I think the name of the party itself pretty well explains it. We believe that the Constitution needs to be the law of the land, needs to be enforced, and that the government has gotten way off from the Constitution. And as a result, that's the reason that we're in such turmoil sometimes and have so many issues.
What specific items do you find most egregious?
Well, I find so many of them, it's hard to say. I find sanctuary cities egregious. I find a situation in the criminal justice system to be egregious.
How so?
Well, the bottom line is that the founders may have made a mistake when they gave federal judges lifetime appointments because they don't follow the Constitution and they even ignore law when it's politically wrong in their opinion. So they are very political and they often ignore what the Constitution and or even common law dictates that they do.
So there were some mistakes in the Constitution.
Well, I think there are mistakes in every document, but I think if we were, even though there are mistakes in the Constitution, if we were fully complying with the Constitution, we'd be way ahead of where we are now. So there are things that could be better, like term limits and a balanced budget amendment. But if we could just get back to the Constitution, it would fix a great majority of our problems.
Term limits is a hot issue here in Michigan. They have obviously failed. You still support them?
Yeah, I don't know too much about Michigan's particular situation, but people who go to the U.S. Senate like Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell and stay 35, 40 years, they don't know what the issues are in the country, and they become, you know, just part of the problem. So I think that there should be term limits just like there is on the presidential position, and I think that I can easily get that, actually.
Yeah, Michigan's situation has deteriorated severely since term limits were imposed. We have more corruption. We have less expertise. We've seen that particularly over the last few months with the COVID-19 situation, because you've got people at this point in the Michigan House of Representatives who, you know, 6 years and they're out.
Yeah.
There is a move afoot. I don't think they're going to eliminate the term limits, but Michigan's are the most strict in the nation. And there is a move afoot to perhaps lengthen them out a little bit, because we've seen a huge increase in the influence of lobbyists, because legislators don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that vacuum gets filled. We've seen a lot more corruption, and we've seen a lot of sleight of hand that's being undertaken now to try to keep those seats in the hands of the party that is having to give them up.
Yeah, I don't know Michigan's situation, but if it's worse in terms of corruption and ignorance in the legislature here than it is in D.C., it's pretty bad, because what's going on in D.C., I mean, you've got, you know, people's families that are in the Senate getting big dollar awards, getting part of the stimulus money. You've got people that are advantaged by the trade policy and their personal businesses getting a lot of money, but they're not talking about, you know, thousands of dollars or even millions. They're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's extremely corrupt, and they're so distanced from reality because they've been there so long. So I believe in the term limits. Maybe it needs to be have other, you know, parameters or other issues like lobbying that you're discussing. But term limits have to be an advantage versus what we've got in D.C. now.
Now, they could have put term limits into the Constitution. Why didn't they?
Well, I would say the biggest problem back then was there wasn't a whole lot of population in the United States, and the guys that were doing it, they may not have even thought about it. I mean, there's a lot of things they did not put in the Constitution that if they had known about today's technology and known what problems there would be today, they would have been different. But the Constitution is not perfect. It's like I said on the front end, it's a whole lot better than what we're doing.
Yeah, because it has been modified a lot over the years. I'm assuming that you don't believe in rolling back votes for women, that you don't believe in reinstituting slavery, that you don't believe that black males should be counted as 60% of people the way that the Constitution originally intended.
Well, I think when I speak of the Constitution, I'm speaking to the Constitution as amended with all the amendments that are in it. There's probably a couple amendments that are questionable, but generally speaking, what we are of the opinion is that we would be better off if we had a law and we followed it. The one thing that's sacred to society is the rule of law. And right now we've got the rule of politicians, and the court system's the rule of politicians, the behavior in D.C. is the behavior of politicians. The Constitution gets ignored. But the Constitution certainly can be adjusted, and it has been adjusted for very good reasons over the years.
Talking with Don Blankenship, he is the presidential candidate of the Constitution Party, known nationally the U.S. Taxpayer Party, as it will appear on the Michigan ballot. William Moore, who is the vice presidential nominee, is also here in the studio. You are a small party. You're not instantly recognizable. You don't get the respect in the national media and perhaps polls and such that the Democrat and Republican parties get. How do you fight the uphill battle for respect?
Well, I think I was a candidate for the West Virginia Senate race last year in 2018 and was on the verge of winning it before the media began to defame me, but which is a long story in and of itself. But I think the key thing is the message, and ultimately it's raising the money in order for people to hear the message, and we're working on that. We look at this election and this trip up here as planting a seed that we hope will grow, because we've elected every president that's been elected since 1870 has been a Democrat or a Republican, and it's not worked out very well in our opinion. So we need a third-party choice, and certainly relying on the Constitution as the foundation of that choice is a safe bet.
I have often wondered about the possibilities of a third party, and then as I think about it, I get scared. I'm not a fan of the Republicans or the Democrats. I'm an independent. But then I look at parties, at countries that have multiple strong parties, and I think, God, do we want to be Italy? Do we want to go through what Israel has just gone through nearly a year without being able to form a government because of the factionalism? Does that make sense?
Well, I think that you can get too many parties, but you can also get too few. The problem we've got in this country now is the politicians are more loyal to the party, and the parties have managed through what they call the National Republican Senatorial Committee and the Democratic Committees to control how the votes are cast in the legislature, because the leaders of those two parties control how the money is delved out to the incumbent candidates, and if they don't vote the way they want them to vote, then they don't fund their campaign. So they basically are able to hold people in line. McConnell, Schumer, Pelosi, and so forth can hold the votes in line, and we don't really have a democracy operating in D.C.
We have been going through one of the most stressful times, I think, in United States history, certainly within my lifetime, and I'm getting old. And for two reasons, let's talk about both of those, starting with this COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of people are sick. A lot of people have been affected by this, even though they haven't been sick. What is the Constitution's party on dealing with a situation? What is your position on dealing with a situation like this? What role should the federal government take?
Well, I think that we can look back in history at other epidemics that we've had, perhaps the tuberculosis one being one of the better ones. I think 1925, I may be off a year or two, but once we realized that tuberculosis was spreading, we had about 625,000 people infected, and they quarantined the 625,000 people. We could have quarantined 200,000 people in New York and made a huge difference in as opposed to where we are now. So we should have quarantined the people that had symptoms. You know, the government told us at that time that asymptomatic people were as dangerous about transmitting the disease as people with symptoms, but it turns out now they're telling us the opposite. But anytime you have a virus spreading, you should quarantine the people that have the virus and not try to quarantine 320 million people. That's what destroyed the economy, and the economy, in my opinion, is going to have a hard time recovering. It'll take 2 or 3 years for it to recover, and it's just really unfortunate because there's no difference between a New Yorker or a New Jersey person that has the virus and somebody from Europe or China. We shut down flights from other countries where the virus was spreading, but we allowed the Northeast to travel all over the United States. And initially, we could have done a lot of good to quarantine them instead of the country.
Does quarantining fly in the face of what some people would say is a basic constitutional right to go and come as they please?
I think some people could argue that, but the bottom line is that you know, the Constitution does give the government the power to protect the people, and when you're protecting the people from a virus by doing the right thing, I think it should be constitutional. What some constitutional lawyer would say, I don't know, but as a practical matter, you cannot allow a virus to spread and destroy the economy. You can't quarantine 320 million people, and you can't shut down the U.S. economy.
Should the government have the authority, as has happened in many cases, to shut down businesses, to order the wearing of masks?
I don't think they can order you to wear a mask. I think that they can strongly recommend that you wear a mask. And actually, I think if it's done properly in terms of communicating it and explaining to people that you're protecting the other guy more than yourself and so on, that you would have got 97% compliance. Americans want to do the right thing and take care of their family and their friends and themselves, and it doesn't take military action to get somebody to wear a mask if it's a serious problem and can be shown to be.
The other thing that we have been fighting, of course, in the United States is problems with racial tensions. You'd like to think that this would somehow go away at some point, but it doesn't seem to have. There are people who feel very strongly that they are fighting an uphill battle to gain equality in the United States. What is the Constitution Party's position on where we are now, the police situation, the heritage statues, all of that stuff? It's a big question, I know.
Yeah, it's a long question. And what the Constitution Party's position is, you would probably have differences of opinion just like you do all over the country. What Don Blankenship's position is that diversity is a big challenge for any government. History has shown that when you have multiple religions and multiple colors of people and multiple opinions, it's very difficult for a government to manage it. That's the reason that in the Middle East we have lots of turmoil and lots of wars, because the Muslim religion is broken into Shiites and Sunnis and so forth, and that's what happened to Iraq, basically. So you first have to stand up and say, we have a problem. Diversity can be, and the media and a lot of politicians like to say, it's the path to American prosperity. It's great. It's a huge benefit. Maybe it is, but it also brings with it a lot of problems. And until you can talk honestly about it, it cannot be resolved unless both sides of the aisle, whether it be white, black, Chinese, Hispanic, whatever, they have to be able to express their opinions without being branded a racist by MSNBC or Fox or whoever it might be. I personally think that anytime you give one sector of a society a privilege, you take away a right from another part of society. And that what happens is the majority of people are afraid to speak out. Majority of politicians are afraid to speak out. I've been known for being willing to speak my mind and say what I think is true. I think it's asking a lot to give favoritism to the black or Hispanic minority communities over whites, because I think it creates dissension and creates divisiveness. And the answer is not, for example, to give lower test scores, set lower test score standards for college admission to different minority groups, but rather to make sure that they have an equal opportunity for education. As a person that grew up in Appalachia, I grew up in a school that was last in the county, a county that was last in the state, and a state that was last in the nation, and I can tell you that you can work yourself out of it. I think the facts are very misunderstood. There's probably 70 more white people in the United States that live below the poverty line than black people. So when you say that you're going to favor black children over white children, you're saying to the poor white people that they are not going to have an equal opportunity to get their kids out of poverty. These are very controversial statements, and the media and others will twist them into racism, but it's really not. If you're going to differentiate one person's child from another person's child in terms of college entrance or whatever, then you create diversity or divisiveness, I should say. And so I think until we can talk honestly and be unafraid to speak honestly about it, it's going to be hard to resolve it.
Does the history of those groups come into play at all? The oppression that blacks have legitimately undergone over the last centuries in the United States. We have here within our listening area the largest Native American tribe in Michigan, the Keweenaw Indian Community. There were certainly a lot of problems, and still are in cases, some cases, between the Native American communities and the federal government. Do those histories come into play in your figuring at all, or is this a point where we should just kind of wipe the slate clean and try to start over?
Well, I don't think you want to totally wipe it clean, but you need to, again, go back to the facts. There was about 4 million, and excuse my lack of exactness, but directionally, about 4 million people, black people brought into the United States into slavery. There's 44 million here today. There's been 4 million come in the last few years just as illegal immigrants. So the ideal that because you have black skin that you do reparations because of slavery is flawed. And the fact that probably the majority of the black people didn't have ancestors that were enslaved in the U.S. I struggle with really understanding what's going on. But if I'm president, I'm going to surround myself with black people, Hispanic people, white people. I'm going to figure out what we can do. But it's the sad truth is that in Africa there's 1.3 million black people and 600 million will live without electricity. And so that's not the problem. The American government or us in here today are not the problem. we've got to be able to speak honestly about it and really understand it. And I'm not saying that some people don't understand it, but I can tell you that I don't quite understand it, and I will be anxious to better understand it. And I think most people in the United States don't understand it. But the key is that, as the old saying goes, you can give a man a fish and it doesn't matter. But if you teach him to fish, he can feed himself for the rest of his life. And the focus is just totally wrong right now because of the political pressure and the fact that you get labeled a racist if you speak honestly about it.
Talking with Don Blankenship, he is the presidential nominee of the Constitution Party. William Moore is here as well. He is their vice presidential nominee. You will see them on the November ballot in Michigan as the Taxpayer Party. They're still working under that name here in Michigan. They're not involved in the August 4th primary coming up. It is a little bit of exception of what we've been doing with these political interviews. We've been focusing on the August 4th primary, but frankly, it's just not all that often we get legitimate presidential candidates to come into the Copper Country, and so I wanted to make sure we had a chance to meet both Don and Bill and give them a chance to explain their position, because we don't get to hear it very often. Police powers, Don. There have been criticisms that the police exercise their power perhaps too frequently at times, particularly in major cities, that power is sometimes expressed too often in terms of those who have skin of color. How do you address the concerns people have about that?
Well, first of all, it is a problem for people of color, but it's also a problem for a lot of people. I can remember when I was poor, you could get pulled over and you're treated entirely different than if you're rich. You know, they pull me over and apologize now. They used to pull me over and lock me up. So it's a, and they do things that they shouldn't do. I mean, I had a personal situation where a policeman pulled me over in Ohio, and because the dog he had with him barked, he thought there was drugs in the car, and I got locked in the back of his cruiser for 2 hours before they figured out that there was no drugs. So it's a power thing. It's a human nature thing. Once you pin a badge and put a uniform on somebody, they often think they are empowered. But we need police officers. We need to fully fund them. We need to train them. We need to make sure they're equipped properly, which in some cases means less arms and less sophisticated guns and so forth. But we have to have police protection. The idea of defunding police is insanity. And I think most everybody out there knows that. I'm surprised that the media has, you know, jumped on the defund police mantra, because it makes no sense.
Well, and as I have talked with people who support it, they don't seem to, the name seems misplaced. What they talk to me about is the concept that maybe some of the money that is, police officers will tell me that a lot of the situations they get sent to are not really situations that they should be involved with in the first place. They involve drugs, which might involve more social workers. They involve family situations. I'm running out of time in this first segment. Can you guys stay for the second segment?
I'd be more than glad to.
We will talk more with Don Blankenship and Bill Moore in just a moment as Copper Country Today continues.
Portage Health Foundation is a proud sponsor of Copper Country Today. This legendary weekly radio program has gone on for decades and has helped listeners dive into important issues here in Michigan's Keweenaw Peninsula. Now, more than ever, we need this kind of in-depth local storytelling in our world. That's why we're happy to help take it to the next level by sponsoring the radio show's debut as a podcast. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Simply search Copper Country Today. Learn more about Portage Health Foundation by visiting phfgive.org.
Welcome back to segment two of Copper Country Today. I'm Todd Van Dyke. Our program is brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation, and our ongoing series on addiction in the Copper Country will continue in just a few minutes, having a conversation with Don Blankenship, who is the presidential nominee of the Constitution Party. and William Moore, who is the vice presidential nominee of the Constitution Party. They will appear, as we've mentioned before, on the November ballot in Michigan as the Taxpayer Party because of a naming situation, but that's who they are. And we're talking about what their party stands for and what their party believes in and their platform as they try to mount a third-party candidacy for the United States presidency. As I was saying before the break, there are people who are in this defund the police movement who are basically saying there are a lot of responsibilities that we have assigned to the police over the last few years that probably really aren't police responsibilities. Social workers may be able to handle it better. Medical workers, mental health workers may be able to handle these things better. Does the federal government have a role in trying to beef up those areas so the police could focus more on the actual hard crimes that they should be?
Off the cuff, without having consulted with a lot of people, I'm not sure what the right answer is. But generally speaking, the federal government has no authority to be involved in policing people on the streets in Chicago or Detroit and so forth. So I would say that they should not be involved. But I do think that the states need to look at the functions that a policeman has and maybe segment those functions and give more specialized training and look at the equipment they have. You know, you mentioned domestic violence. That's one of the most dangerous phone calls that a policeman can take, though. I don't know if I was a social worker that I would want to go into a domestic situation because they often result in criminal acts. So it's a situation where, unlike most politicians who will tell you they know the answers, I don't know the answers. I know the process. I'm a person that will find the answers to these types of problems and will do my best to implement them. Right now, we're in a situation where one party's trying to make hay on one side of that issue and the other one's trying to make hay on the other side. It's the same thing that they do with illegal immigration, abortion, trade policy, about everything that comes up. There's the one party's on one side, one's on the other, and they entertain us with drama and disagreement, but they never achieve anything.
What is the Constitution Party's position on immigration? You mentioned it a moment ago there. Where do you stand?
Well, once you put the word illegal in front of anything, the Constitution Party is against it. So we're against illegal immigration. We don't believe that it should be difficult for responsible people to get into the country legally. Personally, I believe that we should improve the process of getting people into country legally. We should be much like a company where we look at a person and determine whether they're a good person to be part of our company, and we hire good people. At least we should do the same thing about citizenship. I do have a different opinion than many people that I'm close to in regard to what they call the Dreamers. I believe that if you were brought to this country illegally, this country allowed you to get in and you've been here for 25, 30, 35 years and it's the only place you've ever known, that you deserve a chance for citizenship. Whatever that process needs to be would have to be defined. So I recognize the importance of immigrants, the importance of temporary immigrants and the importance of the Dreamers and so forth. But at the same time, people crossing the border illegally is a really bad thing. They bring with them drugs, they bring with them crime, they bring with them diseases, and it puts us out of control. The Democratic Party leadership is totally out of sync with the well-being of their poor members, because illegal immigration is what holds the minimum wage down. And illegal immigrants take a lot of the money away from benefits that should be paid to the poorest Americans and that should be used to get people, street people off the street. So there's a lot of things that need to be fixed. The problem is that it's not in the interest of the Democratic or Republican Party sometimes to fix them.
You mentioned education a few minutes ago. We were talking about opportunities that need to be provided to everybody to be successful in the United States. Does the federal government have a role to play in education, or should that be left simply to the states?
I think the Constitution would say it has to be left to the states because there's no mention of the federal government running it. I do think that standards should be established on a nationwide basis, since kids from high schools all over the country attempt to get into the finest universities all over the country, and we should have as much uniformity as we can. When you go back to...
That starts to sound like that phrase that some people hate so much. That starts to sound like Common Core.
Oh, no. I think Common Core is totally crazy. But I think that teachers should be the ones that are held to a standard. If they can't take a first grade students and have them read at first grade or second grade levels by the end of the first grade, they shouldn't just stay where they are based on tenure. And I think that there's a lot of things like that. Common Core is an absolute disaster. Common Core math is crazy. So is not being able to write, you know, cursive. So for the federal government to be involved in those kind of things is symbolic of what's wrong with the country. They have no business being involved in those things.
Should the federal government stop funding education? Because that's basically how they exert the control, even though it's not necessarily authorized in the Constitution. They dole out money from the checkbook, and the states either pay heel to that or they don't get their cash.
Yes, they should stop funding education, but of course there's always a transition time. But you know, places like Harvard and Columbia are some of the wealthiest institutions in the world, and what needs to happen is that the people who are contributing these hundreds of millions of dollars to these Ivy League schools need to be contributing that money to secondary education or you know, elementary education. We've got too much private and donation money going into the elite universities and not nearly enough going into the high schools.
We're going through a controversy right now as we record this on Tuesday. The state of Michigan just joined into a lawsuit against the Department of Education over the way that money is going to be handed out to schools through the COVID-19 emergency funding. And the basic battle is public schools versus private schools. Where does your party stand on that battle?
Well, I think that the private schools are entitled to an equal treatment by the public schools, but I don't think that the government should be looking at delving the money out to begin with, as we just talked. We've got to get away from the government's ability to control everything through whether they give money or not. I mean, as much as I would like to see sanctuary cities ended, it's not right for the government to use the withholding of money to control states' rights. So it's a very complicated issue. But again, if you think about all the questions you're asking, most of them can go back to the Constitution and be answered. The government's not supposed to be involved in education. And had they not gotten involved, our kids would be better educated. And the private donations and so forth can fund what needs to be funded, but the schools need to be run efficiently as well.
Should the federal government be able to operate at a deficit?
Well, it should not be allowed to operate at a deficit, but, you know, we missed that window of opportunity back there, so we're going to have to do something. And, you know, we operated the United States without an income tax until 1913, and we did it on tariffs. And the reason that that's so important to do it on tariffs rather than on income tax is that you want products to be manufactured in the country, because every step of the process of manufacturing a product, converting iron ore into steel or copper into, you know, to wiring or whatever, those processes create jobs, which creates taxable income for the government at every step of the way. When you go down to Walmart and you buy something that's been imported, you're not funding your Defense Department, your Education Department, your highways, or your Social Security, or your welfare benefits, or anything. That money's going straight through Walmart and back to China for Chinese slave labor or underpaid labor that's polluting the world. So we went totally off base when we abandoned tariffs, and tariffs could be a tremendous benefit both to the budget and to American workers, and also to helping require countries to be more attentive to the environment and more attentive to human rights.
And yet we know that if tariffs are applied at the border, the people who wind up paying the tariffs are not the countries that are involved in shipping the goods in. It's the U.S. taxpayer.
Yes and no. What has happened for, you know, since Nixon went to China is that we've made some Chinese trillionaires. You know, there's a lot of billionaires and more millionaires probably in Beijing than there is in the United States. So what happened is a lot of the money that we paid, and we, you know, we were buying products cheaply, but a lot of that money was going to a few, if you will, people that own companies and so forth in China or that part of the government. So the taxpayers got a break. The products have been cheap, but if you put the tariff on them, the price won't go up as much as the tariff. What will happen is the profits that the illicit producers in other countries are making will go down to a great extent as well.
Your political party platform talks about religion and faith. Where do you stand? Where does the Constitution Party stand?
Well, I stand a little bit different than the party, which is not unusual. Most of the Democrat, Republican, any candidate has a little bit of difference of opinion. But I stand with the fact that religion and the Christian religion are critical to what made this country, and it's critical to what's in the Constitution and critical to a moral life. At the same time, I think that religious freedom, which the founders put in the Constitution, is guaranteed, and it should be apparent to members of the Constitution Party that we have to have that same religious freedom within our party so that we can attract large members to the party and a number of voters and eventually have an influence on the direction of the country.
I have been curious, though, for years why so many people think that the Constitution is Christian when they had the opportunity to put that word in and declined.
Right. Yeah, the word Christian, you know, Jesus Christ, so forth, are not in there. I think the schools, when you go back to dealing with this issue of diversity or divisiveness, should be teaching that a lot of the religions speak very highly of Jesus Christ. Some think he's the Son of God. Some think he's a prophet. Whether you're Muslims, you know, Jewish, whatever, it's something that we should educate people on, that we are not as much different and as much at odds with other religions and peoples of color that the media would have us believe, but we're not educating our children or ourselves as to how much we agree on.
So are you ready to take on Vladimir Putin and Premier Xi and Kim Jong, whomever he is over in Korea at this point? Because if you're elected president, you're suddenly the most powerful man in the world.
Well, I think that, first of all, a president that can name all these different people probably is focused on the wrong thing. You know, I'm very familiar with Vladimir Putin and North Korea and Xi and all that kind of stuff and their names, because that's what's in the news. But what needs to be in the news is what's going on in Hollywood, people sleeping both sides of the street for miles before you can get to the studios, and the coronavirus spreading unnecessarily and people being put out of business and businesses being burned and whatever we're going to have this year, $7 trillion deficit. Charity begins at home. Focus should be at home. And as far as what's going on in the rest of the world, we need to quit policing the world. We have nuclear superiority, and that's what deters other people from behaving differently than we want them to behave, in the extreme at least. And we need to focus on the United States and take care of America.
Well, one of the original tenets of the Constitution was a great fear of the concept of a standing federal army. Mm-hmm. We have now a very large federal army. Would you pull those soldiers home from Germany and from Japan and Korea?
Well, there's 120-some countries that we have federal military forces in, and I would doubt that we would have more than a handful if I were president. I'd have to look and consider, where our vital interest lies. But a lot of times we're just in those countries so that we can boost their economy, and certainly we need to boost our own economy. I would not allow illegal immigrants to come into the country while I was defending the borders of other countries. So there's a lot of things that would be different. The details, one cannot explain what the details would be when he doesn't know all the facts.
So would you reduce the armed forces in general, or would you just simply bring them back here?
Well, being countered by trade, meaning a certified public accountant, my guess is I could cut the budget of every department in the United States government in half and not change what they're doing. The waste, even in big companies, is just unbelievable. The waste in our household is unbelievable. And if you go through a process of systematically determining what we need, I don't know that you would make a great reduction because of the waste factor. And I would try that first, but Department of Energy, I would eliminate the Department of Energy. I would gradually eliminate the Department of Education, and most of these other departments would be greatly reduced.
Yeah, I will confess, I am now in my sixth decade of doing these types of interviews and conversations. I can't count the number of candidates who have come to me and said, we're going to eliminate a whole lot of waste. And they've been elected. And I know that they were sincere when they told it to me. And they, I know that they thought they could do it. And none of them has been able to. So now my question becomes, what makes you more special than all of them?
I'm tougher. You know, if they want to threaten, you know, Trump's good about saying that, go, if you want to shut the government down, go ahead and I'll take credit for it. But I will take credit for shutting the government down. It makes no sense to be so afraid to shut the government down and then turn around and shut the national economy down. I mean, which one would be more damaging to Americans, to shut down the U.S. economy or shut down the U.S. government? It's a matter that, again, the McConnells, the Pelosis, the Schumers of the world have been there so long that when a president shows up, they think that they have control of him because they're not going to bring the bills to the floor. The first thing any newly elected president should do is use the power that he got from being elected by the people to demand that anybody that's in a majority or minority leadership position resign. And let somebody in the position that truly represents the interest of the president and put on the agenda what the president wants done.
But suppose you, Don Blankenship, are elected president, and Bill Moore, you are elected vice president. You're going to get to Washington, and you're still going to have those Republicans and Democrats on the other side of Capitol Hill there who are still firmly entrenched. They're not going to give you the time of day.
It won't matter because we won't give them the budget anywhere we can take it. The executive orders, the fact that we don't have to hire. There's just all kinds of things you can do to bring the government to the realization that they can't continue to be so wasteful, so corrupt, and so divisive of the people. And it's akin, you know, they've basically done more damage to the country than any of our international enemies. As Lincoln said, you know, nobody can even take a foreigner can't take a drink out of the Ohio River, but we can destroy ourselves internally, and that's what we're doing. So you have to treat the people that are in the government as the enemies of the people, and that's a strong statement to make. But you just ask yourself, what are we going to do about a $27 trillion debt? You know, and what are we going to do to keep people from burning places down and so forth? So it's easy to criticize strong words about what needs to be done or strong words about the government, but the fact of the matter is it's time to do something rather than just keep electing the same old Democrat-Republican ideology and watching them fight each other and do nothing.
I've been talking with Don Blankenship. He is the presidential nominee. William Moore has also been here as well. He is the vice presidential nominee of the Constitution Party, which, as we've mentioned and want to make clear, will actually appear on the Michigan ballot in November as the U.S. Taxpayer Party. It's a naming thing. It's nothing more than semantics. But they are here in the Copper Country, and I'm very, very grateful to both of you gentlemen for stopping by and taking up both segments of the program today. I appreciate that you have explained your views in a rational way, and thank you so much for coming, and best wishes to you both.
Thank you very much.
Copper Country Today will continue in just a moment, actually right ahead, with our continuing look at addiction in the Copper Country, focusing this week on the role of law enforcement.
Welcome back to the Portage Health Foundation's Addiction Series. I'm your host, Sarah Blakely. In my current role, I'm the morning news co-anchor at TV6 in Marquette. But prior to that, I spent 2 years right here in the Copper Country as TV6's Houghton Hancock Bureau reporter. During that time, I got to know many of the people behind the scenes at the Portage Health Foundation, and I also got to work closely with the City of Houghton Chief of Police, John Donnelly. In this episode, we'll hear from Chief Donnelly about the vital role law enforcement plays in addiction. It's eye-opening and will help you better understand what's being done to help those in need, even if they don't realize they're in need of that help.
Law enforcement is just that. It is enforcement. You know, I think most family members that are dealing with people that are struggling with addiction are hoping that law enforcement has their interdiction. You know, it's hard to call a your family member out, but usually that's it. You know, if you keep up this behavior, you're going to be arrested. You're going to be held accountable. That's what we really do. We come in and we hold people accountable. And you know, that's how addicts get identified. We have some good services going on to try to help people, such as drug court. If we lock somebody up in jail, if they're an alcoholic, well, they're going to be sober whether they're in jail. If they're addicted to opiates, they can't get opiates in jail. They'll break their cycle while they're in jail. What happens when they get out of jail and they go back in their own environment and they sit at home and have to stay sober there? And that's one thing drug court does, is it tries to force people to be sober in their own setting. First of all, people don't go in and volunteer and say, hey, I want to go into drug court. They get arrested for something, whether it's operating under the influence or stealing. A lot of times we've linked that, had a link between the retail frauds and the theft problems. A lot of times it's stealing from family members, whatever it is to support their habit. We've identified those problems and we've linked that up where people go to drug court. And once they get put in drug court, we have law enforcement officers that go out and test people to see to make sure they're staying sober in their own home setting. And once people can identify and be able to find ways to be sober in their own households, there's a lot better chance for recovery. You know, it's hard for people to ask for help. And in a way, law enforcement comes and holds them accountable and forces them to seek the help that they really need. There's a lot of judgment when it comes to addiction, and people think that it's a choice. I think a lot of studies are saying that it's more of a disease than it is a choice. I often say everybody struggles with addiction. You know, one thing that you think you can control the most is what you put in your body. But whether it's alcohol, whether it's tobacco, whether it's food, or, you know, when you get into these opiates, you know, this opiate addiction, they say 1 in 5 people started when they get their wisdom teeth pulled and they get the first bottle of pills. What's happened lately is the medical profession has backed off on the opiates. It's increased the amount of illegal drugs such as heroin, and that's what people found. It's cheaper to start taking heroin. I'm sure if any one of us shot up heroin every day for 30 days straight, you know, we might think we'd be able to quit on that 31st day, but I don't know, you know, unless you're in that position. I mean, it's proven. It's very, very hard to stop that. Many people have bad habits that they know aren't good for them, and it's hard to overcome those. And that's one of the things I think it's important for law enforcement to do, is try to get out there and find the people that are having addiction problems and hold them accountable and get them into some kind of rehab. And then we have the next level that are people that are have addiction problems, but they're dealing drugs to support those problems. And we want to take those people, get them held accountable, put them in, you know, put them under arrest, get them into drug court, and get them where they can straighten out, where they can find that they don't need to subsidize their own habit by selling drugs, where they can find a different way. But then we also have the supplier that is bringing the narcotics up here. They're not always, oftentimes they don't have addiction problems. They're looking at dollars and cents. And we with the forming of Upset West, we've been able to curve back a lot of that pipeline that was coming up here. For a while, it was low risk and high profit to bring heroin up into this area. People weren't being arrested for it, and it was, you know, you could, for what you could buy it for in the metropolitan areas, and then bring it up here. They were making a huge profits off that. We've tightened things up, and with a higher level of professionalism, like Upset West has brought, we've not only been able to identify some of those suppliers, whereas before we might arrest them and maybe we get a possession charge, now we're actually building cases on them. We're doing cell phone dumps and we're tying them into the as far away as a Mexican cartel, and we're able to indict these people federally and get the suppliers out of the equation. Some of them actually we've heard has said, you know, we're not bringing narcotics back up over the Mackinac Bridge, because every time we do, we're getting caught. And that's what we want to do. The key would be to have less people get addicted to, especially the street drugs like heroin and such like that, and try to push it back to where we can identify them when they're struggling with Vicodin and some of the prescription problems. I think our chances are a lot better at having, you know, recovery in the addiction world. That's where we come into play. And you know, most people will say, well, you know, they're doing this and this and that, but who are they bothering? Well, when they start getting arrested, and then they have to explain things. And I think that's, you know, that is our job. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to identify those kind of problems in the community and bring them to light. And people have a real hard time saying, you know, coming out and saying that they're an addict. But when you find them stealing in Walmart and you find they have, they have a crusher to crush up their pills and a straw to snort them, you know, and then they try to maintain that they don't have a problem. You know, we're the people that come out and call their bluff. Oftentimes the family members, the close family members know, but oftentimes other people don't know. And the addiction science of the opiates, a lot of times aren't as prevalent as it would be with, you know, you can't smell the alcohol on them or anything else like that. You get into some of the meth and stuff like that, well, then you can actually, you can see the physical signs. You have the teeth that are decaying and the sores on their face. But a lot of these prescription problems and heroin problems are kind of harder to identify until we have some kind of encounter with them and, you know, we know what we're looking for. Since we've introduced Upset West, they've not only brought a different level of professionalism, they actually come out and they educate the road officers that are out there looking. And you know, it used to be you're looking for a bag of marijuana, which smelled and it's leafy and it's pretty easy to find. Well, when you're just looking for a couple pills, you know, you have to start looking for other signs like spoons or needles. You might not actually find the drugs, but you find all the things that surround the drugs, all the paraphernalia that goes along with it, and then you can look further into the problem there.
Thanks to Chief Donnelly for sharing his experience of helping those with addiction. We'll hear more from him later on in this series, including an entire episode diving into what the Western Division of the Upper Peninsula Substance Enforcement Team, or Upset West, has accomplished since its inception. In episode 5, we'll hear from Kevin Storr, the executive director of the Portage Health Foundation. He'll talk more about the economic impacts that addiction has on our community. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, know that there are resources available in our community. Dial Help is a great place to start. They have a crisis line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, based right here in the Copper Country. Just dial 906-482-HELP, text 906-35-NEEDS, or chat live with someone at dialhelp.org. If you're in any kind of medical emergency, dial 911 immediately. To learn more about the resources available in our community or to subscribe for email alerts for future episodes, just visit phfgive.org/addiction.
When our community is in need, the Portage Health Foundation is here to answer the call. In 2018, we were here on the front lines helping homeowners get their lives back. And now with the COVID-19 pandemic, we're right here with the many nonprofits who help serve our community. We've provided funding to Senior Meals, Keweenaw Family Resource Center, and 31 Backpacks. We launched a Wi-Fi hotspot network to help families stay connected, and we have much more planned. If you want to donate to help our community's recovery, visit phfgive.org/COVID-19 or call 523-5920.
I hope you enjoyed this morning's Copper Country Today. Thanks to our guests, Constitution Party presidential candidate Don Blankenship and vice presidential candidate William Moore. Don't usually focus on national politics, but it's not often we get visits from actual presidential candidates from any party here in the Copper Country. Our series on addiction in the Keweenaw will continue next Sunday. Copper Country Today is heard each Sunday morning at 7 on 97.7 The Wolf, 8 on 99.3 The Lift, and 9 o'clock on KBAR 102. You can also listen to our podcast at QAnonReport.com, iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and a number of other streaming platforms. Copper Country Today is brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation. Learn more about them and their mission at phfgive.org. This is a copyrighted public affairs production of Houghton Community Broadcasting.